So on September 29, 2006, two jets collided head-on over the Amazon.
Right.
And one of them, this massive Boeing commercial airliner, it just plummeted into the dense Mato Grosso jungle, leaving absolutely no survivors.
Yeah, which is just, it's a horrific tragedy.
It is. But then the other plane, which was a much smaller Embraer Legacy business jet, it actually suffered the exact same initial impact. But it managed to stabilize, land safely, and amazingly, every single one of its seven occupants walked away without a scratch.
It's almost unbelievable when you hear it.
Right. So today, for you listening, we are looking at the impossible geometry of that crash. Welcome to the deep dive.
Thanks. And, you know, we're pulling from the historical records, investigation summaries, and all the subsequent governmental inquiries surrounding Brazilian aviation accidents for this.
Yeah, we really wanted to get into the weeds on this one.
Exactly. Because the mission for this analysis is to investigate how a highly specific technical failure happening miles above this remote, dense forest basically acted as a devastating catalyst that brought this bubbling nationwide aviation crisis right out of the
It
shadows.
really is a staggering contrast right from the very first moment. I
Yeah.
mean, the physics of mid-air collisions are just inherently chaotic, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So for one aircraft to be completely obliterated while the other essentially just, flies home, it forces us to look at this not just as a tragedy, but really as a forensic puzzle.
Right.
Like, how do two highly advanced aircraft ever end up occupying the exact same physical space in an essentially infinite sky?
Well, that's the thing, right? The vastness of the sky is actually, it's kind of an illusion when it comes to commercial flight.
Wait, what do you mean by an illusion?
So the reality of modern aviation is that the sky is crisscrossed with these incredibly precise, invisible highways. And when those highways are managed correctly, the system is just a marvel of human engineering. But those highways rely entirely on a very, very strict set of technological guardrails.
Right. Okay, let's unpack this. Let's look at the specific flight paths of September 29. Because the sheer improbability of this collision is really where the entire investigation begins.
Yeah, it really is.
So the smaller plane, the Legacy business jet, it was flying from San Jose dos Campos heading to Brasilia. And according to the flight plan, the Legacy was instructed to cruise at an altitude of 37,000 feet.
Right.
But then at a very specific waypoint, it was supposed to descend to 36,000 feet.
Exactly. And that planned descent is basically the core of aviation safety. Altitude separation is the absolute bedrock of air traffic control.
Right, because you can't just have planes flying at whatever height they want.
Exactly. Aircraft traveling in opposite directions along these invisible highways, they're assigned different altitudes. Usually it's separated by like 1,000 feet. It's a fundamental design meant specifically to completely eliminate the risk of a head-on collision.
But the thing is, the Legacy never made that descent.
No, it didn't.
It just remained cruising at 37,000 feet and coming in the exact opposite direction, cruising completely normally at that exact same assigned altitude of 37,000 feet, was the Gull Boeing passenger jet. Flight 1907.
Yeah, so you have two aircraft moving at hundreds of miles an hour, head on, sharing a single altitude layer.
But wait, I mean, even if they were at the exact same altitude due to a missed descent, ground control is, they're staring at screens watching these blips converge.
Right.
Like, I know the sky is massive, but we have an entire infrastructure designed to monitor it. How did no alarm go off in the control tower? I mean, you have an entity literally designed to prevent planes from touching, and they somehow allow two aircraft to fly straight at each other over the Amazon.
Well, see, that assumes the controllers were actually seeing the complete picture.
They weren't.
No, because ground control's, eyes in the sky, they aren't optical. Controllers are not looking out a window with binoculars.
Right, of course.
To understand why no one stopped this, you have to understand the difference between primary and secondary radar.
Okay, lay that out for us.
So, primary radar is basically just a ground station shooting out a radio wave. If that wave hits a giant metal tube in the sky, it bounces back, and the controller sees a blip on their screen.
Okay, makes sense.
But all that primary radar tells them is that a physical object exists at a certain latitude and longitude.
Oh, I see. It doesn't tell them how high up the object is.
Precisely. To get altitude, controllers rely on secondary radar.
Okay.
And secondary radar doesn't just bounce off the plane, it actually actively interrogates the plane.
Interrogates it.
Yeah, so the ground station sends up a signal basically asking, who are you and how high are you? And then a device on the aircraft broadcasts a digital reply containing its identification code and its exact barometric altitude.
Okay, and that device is.
That device is called the transponder.
The transponder.
Right.
Right. And, you know, looking at the historical records, the investigation revealed that the absolute core technical failure of this flight was the deactivation of the Legacy Jet's transponder.
Yes.
It just went dark.
Yeah, and when that transponder went dark, the secondary radar had nothing to interrogate. So the controllers were suddenly left looking at just a primary radar blob.
Wow.
They could see a plane was moving across the map, sure, but the critical data tag showing its altitude was just gone, or, well, frozen.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me, though. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand how this is even possible. Because the pilots of the Legacy insisted adamantly that they did not turn off the transponder.
Right, they were very clear on that.
They claimed they never touched the controls for it.
Yeah.
So let's assume for a moment that they are telling the truth. I mean, I just bought a toaster that aggressively beeps at me if the crumb tray is full, you know?
Yeah.
Or, like, I get a flashing red light on my dashboard if my car's tire pressure drops by, like, 3 PSI. You are telling me a piece of equipment vital to the basic survival of a multi-million dollar jet can just quietly stop working without alerting anyone.
Well, what's fascinating here is that the lack of an immediate, unmistakable auditory or visual alarm for a disconnected transponder is, it's really the terrifying technical mystery at the center of this whole thing.
It really is.
Whether it was an accidental, unnoticed physical bump of a switch by a pilot or, you know, a silent internal software failure, the result was functionally identical. The transponder deactivated and the pilots were completely unaware of it.
So they're sitting in the cockpit, cruising at the wrong altitude, totally oblivious to the fact that ground control can no longer see how high they are.
Right. And actually, it's worse than just ground control losing their altitude.
Wait, how could it be worse?
Because the transponder doesn't just talk to the ground, it talks to other planes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Modern aircraft are equipped with collision avoidance systems, TCAS, that essentially act as an onboard safety net. But those onboard systems rely entirely on reading the transponders of nearby aircraft.
So if it's off?
If Plane A's transponder is off, Plane B's collision system simply cannot see it, period.
That's terrifying.
It is. By losing that one piece of technology, the Legacy Jet basically became a ghost plane. It was rendered invisible to both the ground controllers below and the Boeing jet flying directly toward it.
You know, it proves a deeply unsettling point about systems engineering. We surround ourselves with the most sophisticated, advanced machines imaginable, assuming that complexity equals safety.
Right.
But a system is completely reliant on its ability to communicate failure. In this cockpit, the failsafe to alert the pilots either didn't exist or it didn't trigger in a way that cut through the routine environment of a long flight. They were flying blind to their own invisibility.
That invisibility is the crucial first step. But in accident investigations, we look at something called the Swiss cheese model.
I've heard of this, yeah.
Yeah, so imagine multiple slices of Swiss cheese stacked on top of each other. Each slice represents a layer of defense. The pilots, the onboard technology, the ground radar, the air traffic controllers. And every slice has holes in it, representing potential failures. Normally, a failure in one layer is stopped by the solid part of the next layer.
So, like, if the transponder fails, which is the hole in the first slice of cheese, the air traffic controller is supposed to notice the missing altitude data and radio the plane. That's the solid part of the next slice.
Exactly. That's exactly how it should work. But for a disaster to actually happen, the holes in every single slice of cheese have to align perfectly so that the failure passes straight through the entire system.
Wow.
And what the investigators found when they looked into Gulf Flight 1907 was that the transponder failure was really just the very first domino to fall. The safety nets beneath the aircraft weren't just flawed, they were completely compromised.
Yeah, because the records show that the investigation quickly widened beyond the cockpit. And it brought this massive, bubbling, nationwide crisis fully into the light.
It really did.
The investigators found severe systemic deficiencies in Brazilian air traffic control and safety protocols.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't just a controller having a bad day in a tower.
No, not at all.
There were ongoing, widespread issues at the airports, severe equipment limitations, and a highly overburdened workforce of air traffic controllers.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, that broader context shifts the entire narrative. We are no longer looking at a freak, isolated technical anomaly over the Amazon.
Right.
We are looking at the inevitable result of a fundamentally deficient infrastructure. I mean, think about the pressure on an air traffic controller. They are managing dozens of aircraft at once.
Yeah.
If their radar equipment is outdated, or if there are known coverage gaps over remote regions like the dense Mato Grosso forest, their ability to actively monitor and correct a single missing data tag is severely reduced.
It's like finding a single broken wire in your house. But when you open the wall to fix it, you realize the entire electrical grid of that house is actively melting.
That is a perfect way to put it, actually.
Or it's like driving on a highway at night with no lane dividers and no rumble strips. If everyone is perfectly awake and steering straight, you're fine.
Yeah.
The system appears to be working. But the second one, driver sneezes, which is our technical failure, right? The transponder turning off. There are no guardrails to catch them. They just drift into oncoming traffic. The Brazilian air traffic control system had basically lost its rumble strips.
Yeah, the system completely lacked the resilience to handle an anomaly. Because in a robust, healthy aviation infrastructure, a single failure, like a deactivated transponder, is caught.
Right. Someone notices.
Exactly. A controller sees the altitude data drop, radios the plane and says, hey, check your transponder. But when the system itself is struggling with systemic issues, whether that's staffing shortages, inadequate training, or faulty radar displays, the margin for error shrinks to absolute zero.
Wow.
The latent conditions for disaster were already in place. They were just waiting for an active failure to trigger them.
And because that systemic rot was so deep, the environment was incredibly fragile. The entire country was essentially sitting on a powder keg, waiting for the next disaster to strike. And tragically, horribly, it did.
Yeah. The timeline here is really critical to understanding the sheer scale of the institutional collapse that followed.
Yeah, walk us through that.
So the collision of Gulflight 1907 occurred in September 2006. At the time, with the complete loss of all lives on the Boeing, it became the second worst aviation disaster in Brazil's history.
Just devastating.
Right. And the psychological toll on the nation was profound. The aviation system was suddenly under a microscope.
But the bleeding hadn't stopped. The systemic issues hadn't actually been fixed. Because just months later, in July 2007, the unthinkable happens again. The TAM Airlines crash occurs at Congonhas Airport.
Yeah. And that crash at Congonhas surpassed the Gol disaster, claiming 199 lives. It instantly became the worst aviation disaster in the country's history.
Unbelievable.
So within a span of less than a year, Brazil suffered two back-to-back historic aviation catastrophes.
I mean, you have the Gol crash in the remote Amazon, which exposed the specific air traffic control weaknesses and technical blind spots. Then, before the dust can even settle, you had the TAM crash right in the heart of São Paulo at one of the busiest airports in the country.
Exactly.
The sheer scale of the grief, compounded by the panic of anyone who had to buy a plane ticket, it completely shattered public trust. It created an absolute political breaking point.
Well, and this raises an important question about how governments respond, because when you have compounding tragedies on a national scale, the pressure cooker environment means the government can no longer manage the situation with, you know, minor bureaucratic tweaks.
Right. You can't just release a memo.
Exactly. The public was demanding accountability for an infrastructure that was actively failing them. The political armor of these massive agencies just began to fracture under the weight of the fatalities.
We see that fracturing start right at the top. Because the historical records show this crisis directly forced the resignation of the Minister of Defense, Walder Pires.
Yeah. And the Ministry of Defense in Brazil oversees the Aeronautics Command, which is deeply intertwined with the management of air traffic control.
Okay, that makes sense.
So having a defense minister resign over a civilian aviation crisis underscores just how deeply the systemic failure had penetrated the state's apparatus. The military and civilian infrastructure were inextricably linked, and the failure of the latter brought down the leadership of the former.
Right.
But, you know, the government didn't stop at the ministry level.
No, they didn't. The entire top leadership of the National Civil Aviation Agency, ANAC, was completely overhauled. They essentially gutted the executive branch of the very regulatory agency tasked with ensuring the safety of civil aviation.
Right.
Think about the sheer political inertia required to accomplish that. I mean, anyone who has ever tried to get their city council to fix a single pothole knows how slowly government moves.
Yeah, it's glacial.
Now imagine the monumental political willpower required to fire the entire leadership of a federal agency. It essentially took a public mutiny, fueled by those back-to-back tragedies, to break through that bureaucratic armor.
Sweeping governmental reforms like that, they rarely happen proactively.
Well,
restructuring an agency's mandate, overhauling its leadership, and admitting that the oversight mechanisms have failed, it requires unimaginable catalysts. It took the combined loss of life from both the Gaul and Tam disasters to create an undeniable, unavoidable mandate for reform.
And to make sure those reforms actually address the root causes rather than just offering up, you know, political scapegoats, the government established two parliamentary commissions of inquiry specifically to investigate the crisis.
And parliamentary commissions of inquiry are incredibly powerful investigative tools. They aren't just internal audits.
What's the difference?
Well, they have the authority to subpoena documents, compel expert testimony under oath, and really dig deep into the systemic roots of a failure. Establishing two separate commissions highlights the profound complexity of the crisis. You need one investigative body looking at the immediate sharp-end technical causes, the transponders, the radar blind spots, the cockpit interfaces.
Right.
And you need another body dissecting the blunt-end failures, the financial allocations, the administrative oversight of ANAC, and the systemic neglect of the air traffic control infrastructure.
So what does this all mean for you, the person listening right now? We all live in complex societies where we implicitly trust these massive alphabet soup government agencies to keep us safe.
Yeah, we do.
We trust ANSI in Brazil, the FAA in the United States, the ESA in Europe. We buckle our seatbelts, we look out the window, and we just assume the sky is proactively managed.
Right.
But it took nearly 350 lives across two back-to-back crashes for a government to actually look inside the walls and rewire a melting system. It leaves you wondering, how can the public ever truly know if a safety agency is actively catching the missing slices of cheese before they align, or if they're just bureaucratically waiting to react to the next unavoidable disaster?
Yeah, it's a sobering thought. The overhaul of ANSI and the launch of those parliamentary inquiries were deeply reactive measures.
Absolutely.
But the ultimate goal of that massive reaction is to build an infrastructure that is fundamentally proactive moving forward. Accident investigation is about finding the missing rumble strips and reinstalling them so the next time a technical failure occurs, the system can absorb the shock without collapsing.
It is a heavy reality to sit with. Tracing the arc of this deep dive, it is staggering to think about the chain of causality here.
It really is.
I mean, it all started with a single silent piece of technology on a business jet. A transponder goes dark. An altitude discrepancy of exactly 1,000 feet over the dense Mato Grosso forest goes unnoticed.
And two aircraft collide because the invisible highways lost their guardrails. A Boeing falls into the Amazon.
Yeah.
And the resulting shockwave travels all the way from the jungle canopy to the highest halls of government, exposing widespread ATC deficiencies, forcing a defense minister to step down, and mandating the complete structural overhaul of a nation's civil aviation authority.
It really makes you realize that every single time you step onto a plane, the safety protocols you are relying on in that very moment were likely forged in the direct aftermath of tragedies, exactly like the collision of Gulf Flight 1907. We are kept safe today by the hard, terrible lessons learned in the past.
Yeah. And, you know, as we reflect on those lessons, particularly on the terrifying mystery of the Legacy's transponder going dark without the crew ever realizing it, there is a lingering thought we should all consider about the world we navigate today.
What's that?
Well, if highly trained professional pilots can be completely unaware that their primary safety communication tool has stopped working, it forces us to look critically at our own environment.
Right.
How many automated silent systems in our own daily lives, from the automatic braking sensors in our cars to the digital infrastructure protecting our financial data, lack the fail-safes required to loudly and aggressively alert us before a silent failure becomes a total catastrophe?
Wow. Yeah, it brings us right back to the beginning. We walk around every day relying on complex, invisible systems, trusting that the vastness of the space around us will keep us safe. But when the technology we rely on goes silent without warning, you have to wonder what else we're suddenly blind to. Till next time, thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.